Few general interest magazines are still publishing short stories these days. A notable exception is Esquire, which won a 2004 National Magazine Award for fiction. Adrian Miller has served as Esquire's literary editor since 1997, but recently she's published her own novel, her first, entitled The Coast of Akron. It's from Farrah Straus and Giroux, and I'm very pleased it has brought Adrian Miller to my show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here.
And if this becomes a bestseller, do you give up the day job?
If it becomes a bestseller, how many people listen to your show? Let's make that happen.
Akron, Ohio is a landlocked city, so are you giving us a clue when you give the title The Coast of Akron?
The Coast of Akron is a sort of bitter recurring joke throughout the book, in a book of 400 pages of bitter recurring jokes. that's one of the many. Basically, why is it the title? I don't know, because I couldn't come up with anything better. It was kind of the last title that I thought of. And I know this book took me 5 years of work, and the first 4 years were me sort of trying to figure out that Akron, where I'm from in Ohio, is actually a central, in fact, probably the central character in the book.
And how much of the real Akron makes it into this book?
It has a lot more to do with my imaginary fictional Akron, with my sort of dream Akron, kind of growing up as a very sort of fanciful, weird, poetic child.
But everybody is fictionalizing in this book. Even though most of them are involved in the visual arts, they all seem to be creating Akrons or personas that are not really based on reality.
Mm-hmm.
We have Fergus Goldwyn, who writes fake magazine articles about himself in the voice of a famous magazine journalist, and he writes about his famous, impeccably turned out 100-room Tudor mansion in the coast of Akron, Ohio.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, these characters exist mentally sort of purely in their heads and in their imaginations, which I think is very sort of realistic. You know, when I was growing up in Akron, most of the people I knew there and sort of like the sort of wacky artist people were the folks who created their own realities and created their own strange personalities. It's a book about self-dramatization and self-creation.
And about, identity problems.
Identity problems, yes, lots of problems, but identity problems is definitely one of the central problems in the book.
An inspiration seems to be Cindy Sherman, the photographer who cast herself in many different roles.
Mm-hmm.
You have a key figure here, the artist Lowell Haven, who does something similar. Then there's the whole matter of whether he actually does it or whether somebody else does
mm-hmm.
it. So here again, it's about artists and the way people perceive artists?
I think so, yeah. The themes, whatever themes are there are sort of there indirectly. I was sort of governed by the character, by kind of finding convincing voices for the characters. But the artist that you mentioned, who's the sort of patriarch of this crazy family, the Haven family, Lowell Haven, is a world-famous artist who has achieved a sort of Warholian-type fame by painting. Or does he paint them himself? Or does his estranged ex-wife paint them? Full-scale self-portraits, Cindy Sherman-esque in the way that you mentioned, but sort of dressed up in various historical garb. Most famously, there's a cycle of Canterbury Tales paintings in which she's dressed up as the wife of Bath, the Franklin, the Reeve, all of the Canterbury Tales characters.
And a lot of this is about the art world, some of it making fun of it. Has the art world become totally ridiculous these days?
I don't actually know a lot about the art world. I think I did a bit of research, and I hope that people who read the book, who know more about the art world than I do, think it's convincing. But it sort of indirectly put a lot of my opinions about the literary world in here, sort of masked through the art world.
See, I thought it was a lot of art in jokes. For example, his wife is named Jenny Meatyard.
Mm-hmm.
There was a late photographer, Ralph Meatyard.
Yes.
Who made photos of people in Halloween masks.
Yes.
Masks play a role here. The book ends in a costume character. And I thought, is this for people who really know what has gone on in the art world over the last 50 years or so?
I don't know. I mean, I hope that it would appeal to a wider audience than that. I mean, the Ralph Eugene Meatyard reference, actually, that was sort of my, Jenny Meatyard was sort of my working name for the central female character. And I always sort of thought, like 3 years, 4 years down the road, that I would change her name to something else, because Meatyard was, Ralph Eugene Meatyard's work was so important to me. And it's just such an odd, ridiculous name, Meatyard. What nationality is that? I don't know.
I guess that's why I noticed it. I thought, where did she come up with Meatyard? Well, obviously, the famous photographer.
Exactly. And actually, my first job ever was when I was 17, and I worked at the Akron Art Museum, actually, and I was an assistant on the first ever Ralph Eugene Meatyard retrospective.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so he's been a very hugely influential, important artist, and the mask thing is so strange and creepy to me.
Of course, a major unreality of this whole thing is that there is a famous artist who lives in Akron, Ohio. Don't most famous artists live in the major art centers?
My father is from Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, which is around where Andrew Wyeth lives, and so I've sort of grew up with while growing up in Ohio, but with my father's sort of the childhood importance in his life of Andrew Wyeth growing up as the sort of larger than life kind of mythical, extremely elusive artist in Westchester County, Pennsylvania, of all places. I think that I probably wouldn't have been kind of as interested in a sort of mythical artist had Andrew Wyeth not had that sort of place in my early childhood.
Although the slipperiness of subjectivity is a major theme here, you've grounded the novel pretty much in the here and now with references ranging from South Park to Donald Rumsfeld to Eminem to Lucian Freud. Was it important to maintain a thread of grounded reality, or is Donald Rumsfeld as much an unreal character as Lowell Haven is?
It's an interesting question. I don't know. I mean, I was just trying to write a book about what it felt like to be alive during the years that I wrote it, and Donald Rumsfeld during the 2000 to 2005 or 2004 when I wrote the book was such a kind of huge factor, unfortunately, in all of our lives. But I don't know.
His wife loves him very much.
Oh, yes.
So does the president.
But those references and the BlackBerry and these sort of like the jarring, brand names that I suppose maybe I was trying to sort of remind the reader that while this is a surrealist, sort of fanciful world, that it actually is happening. It is taking place in the real world.
Would you have written a book like this if you hadn't been the literary editor at Esquire?
I think if I hadn't been the literary editor of Esquire at this point in my life and career, I probably would have been on my second book, my second or third book.
But would be similar? Because, Don DeLillo, for example, is one of the writers you've worked with, and people will see certain similarities.
Oh, huh, interesting.
In the way that he deals with reality and unreality or surreal reality or whatever we want to call it.
I think that I've been both sort of in the DeLillo way, sort of both positively influenced by my time at Esquire and frankly negatively influenced by my time reading for the last decade. I read at another magazine, Fiction, before coming to Esquire, and reading lots and lots and lots of short story submissions, some of which are good, most of which, as any editor will tell you, are not very good. So, so I was also sort of trying to write a book sort of unlike a lot of the submissions that I saw, not a sort of pimply kind of, autobiographical, sort of grittily realistic book, but something that was hopefully new and that interested me and that could interest me for the course of half a decade of writing this book.
So that's what you saw mostly, is autobiographical or faintly veiled?
Thinly veiled. I think that is generally, I think, the sort of, unsolicited sort of slush pile fiction seems to be largely thinly veiled autobiographical stuff. You can tell that there is no sort of inspiration involved in a lot of this stuff, that it's just purely memoir, memoir sort of with a short story title on it.
Although some people do that better than others because they write better than others.
Yes, yes. And some people's lives are more interesting than others, too.
Are you depressed that we have so few magazines publishing fiction today? Or, as you suggest, perhaps, isn't there all that much good stuff out there to be published? Perhaps Esquire, The New Yorker, and a couple of other magazines are enough.
It's really only Esquire, The New Yorker, Harper's now, because The Atlantic doesn't publish monthly fiction anymore. And so how many short stories is that a year combined altogether, like plus The New Yorker, not even 100
short stories? Well, The New Yorker is just about 12 a year. They barely publish, except for their fiction issues, more than one an issue.
So it's not a lot of short stories. Are there more than, you know, more than a dozen or a couple dozen short stories, good short stories written a year? God, I hope so. I think there are. And, you know, I mean, looking at, you know, I mean, Mademoiselle published fantastic fiction. Women's magazines published up until 20 years ago important fiction. It's just become a sort of marginalized pocket of our culture, the short story. And a glossy magazine.
And why do you think that is? After all, we still buy collections of short stories. Alice Munro remains a much-loved writer, for example. Joyce Carol Oates writes wonderful short stories.
I don't know. I mean, I've been for my, you know, 7 or 8 years at Esquire have been trying to figure this out. Why don't people read short stories?
Well, do they not read them? Do the collections not sell?
The collections,
James Salter,
yeah,
recently had a very well-received collection.
Mm-hmm, right.
Do you think that book will sell?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think so. I think that the books, you know, sell incredibly well. And, I mean, Melissa Bank, I mean, there have also mm-hmm. been incredibly commercial short story collections, too, within the last several years. But I don't know. I mean, don't ask me. Ask culture why it doesn't value, you know, the short story in magazines.
But you've written a novel, not a short story.
It's only because I can't write short stories.
Really?
I'm too long-winded. I'm just too. I just go on and on and on. And the short story is about, you know, omission and indirection, which does not appear to be my talent. My talent appears to be, if I do have one, about just sort of piling on and adding.
Well, writing the novel allows you to do a lot of digression, which is part of the fun, isn't it? I've always wondered about the paring down necessary for a short story. There are just too many ideas I'd have to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of the way my sort of disorganized, unordered mind kind of works, too.
Well, that in a way, that's good also, because then you're not competing with the people you're editing.
Exactly. Oh, which is just not a good idea, because I have worked with so many incredible writers.
Well, that is also a problem when some people do see the connection between the edited work and the writers that are edited, or critics who then publish books and are now held to the standards that they apply to other people.
Mm-hmm. I do find that. I mean, I do find that in reviews of this book that I seem to have skipped a grade, if you will, that I feel that this book isn't necessarily sort of being treated like a sort of, you know, an ambitious but first novel, emphasis on first novel, which I'm fully aware that it's my first novel, and I hope that my future novels will be better. I mean, as we all, I mean, why else continue? But definitely as somebody who's made a living as a critic and as an editor, you definitely do feel that the stakes are sort of higher for you.
Usually writers start off with a first-person narrator or a third-person narrator. You have three narrators here, one in diary form, one first-person, one very closely held third-person. This is the sort of thing that people challenge themselves with later on in the mm-hmm. second book, usually. Mm-hmm. Is mm-hmm. there a first book that never made it?
No, there actually isn't. This is my first, which isn't actually a very popular answer, because I actually don't, unlike so many writers, have a shelved first novel. But no, this is the first thing I attempted. Before this book, and this book started, I guess, in late 99, early 2000, I was writing really, really not very good short stories. And given my job as an evaluator of short stories, I sort of knew when to kind of pack that part of my career up.
It would have been embarrassing if
definitely not
if one of your writers said to you, "How dare you tell me what to do with this story, considering what you just
published. Yes, considering what you're capable of
writing. Well,
it must
have been rough anyway, because you became the literary editor of Esquire at a fairly early age, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes, yes, I did. I owe my career to my mentor, who's the editor-in-chief of Esquire, David Granger. And also to luck and timing, my twin gods, luck and timing. Thank you very much, luck and timing. I was going to go to grad school and get an MFA in fiction like every other English major, but ended up a week before I graduated from college getting a job at another magazine where I worked for a couple of years, and then the job at Esquire opened up. I've been incredibly lucky and fortunate in my career. I don't, I fully understand that, and I'm very aware of that.
Do you ever encounter any issues of authority, stubborn writers who don't want to take advice from a young editor?
I actually haven't. I mean, and I say that quite truthfully. I might just be not aware of it. Maybe I'm just so not. I mean, I've never really had sort of experienced sort of issues of self doubt really while editing short stories. I suffer plenty of self-doubt in my real life as a person and as a writer, but as an editor, no, I really haven't had that many, fortunately, that many conflicts like that.
Well, now you have this book published, and I'm assuming you're hooked and there are going to be more.
I hope so. I'm trying to write something now that is not very good, and that appears to be the way I write. The first couple of years, the thing is just not very good, and then it just kind of a few years later just takes a life on its own.
But what happens? You just figure it out, or you look it over and say, oh, that's what I want to stress. Get rid of all that other stuff.
It's for me. I seem to write with voices, and it's largely a process of finding. And achieving a voice that I find is real and convincing and alive.
Adrian Miller will read from The Coast of Akron at 7 o'clock tomorrow at Firebird Books, or Freebird Books. Is it Freebird Books?
I think it's Freebird.
In Carroll Gardens. That's 123 Columbia Street. And the book, The Coast of Akron, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.